I'm Dave Cusick, and my guest is John Linnell. He and John Flansburgh co-created the band They Might Be Giants over 20 years ago in New York City. The band has released over 10 full-length albums and is still going strong, touring the U.S. constantly. I caught up with John Linnell before their first of three consecutive shows in Portland's Aladdin Theater during the weekend of May 3rd, 2003.
So how did you guys, you and John, meet originally?
Well, we went to the same school system outside of Boston, and I don't think either one of us is like completely clear on when exactly we met, but we became friends in high school. I think probably when John was a freshman, I was a sophomore. We got to know each other through the high school newspaper, but we'd met before then. I think we'd met in elementary school. In junior high, in other words.
What was your hometown that you grew up in?
The town is called Lincoln, and the high school is Lincoln Sudbury High School. And we still have family out there. It's just like 20 miles west of Boston.
What was that like?
It's a nice little suburb. It's very it's pretty like upper middle class kind of a scene out there. It's actually more expensive now than it was then. I think if John and I wanted to live there, we probably couldn't afford to at this point. It's like a colonial style place. Just a lot of super old, like 300-year-old houses and stuff like that out there. And it's mostly woods and, it's very Massachusetts-y, like they have a town meeting and stuff like that. You know, it's sort of old school in that sense.
So where did you guys fall in socially, like in high school?
Well, you know, I think at the time we sort of felt like we were on the outside. You know, we were disenfranchised. We had a clique in high school which consisted of the people who worked on the newspaper, but we sort of felt like we were not the part of the scene. And then I think gradually, like I think eventually we figured out that's pretty much everybody's experience in high school, you know, that nobody's like fully on the inside. Everyone feels a little bit like a weirdo, maybe it wasn't as dramatically different for us as it was for everybody else, you know. But we were, you know, and part of the thing was that we were really into this newspaper, and that was kind of how we identified ourselves, and the newspaper was generally sort of disliked by the rest of the school body, I think, you know. So it was sort of like we were writing this thing for ourselves, more or less, you know, which is a little sad.
When and why did you both decide to move to New York?
Well, we had different reasons. John had been going to college. He went to a series of different colleges, but he wound up transferring to an art school in Brooklyn. And that same autumn that he moved to Brooklyn, I was playing in a band in Providence, Rhode Island, and the band decided that, you know, in order to move to the next step, we were going to have to move to New York and, you know, get serious or something like that. And so that same fall, which was 1981, we all, you know, got in a van. Actually, John and I moved together because we were still in touch with each other and still friends. And so John and I moved John was moving his stuff from Boston, and he stopped and picked me up in Providence along with, like, my two suitcases, and we moved, and that was everything we had, and we moved to the same building in Brooklyn that, you know, a friend of ours had figured out there were two apartments that were opening up for me and John to move into. And then promptly I stopped playing with this band, like, very soon after I got to New York. I stopped playing with the band, and not to do anything else in particular, I just was, you know, sort of felt like I'd done everything I was going to do with the band, and concentrated on writing songs and stuff in New York, and John and I started working together around that time.
When you first started out working with John, were you doing the same kind of music basically that you're doing now, like sort of absurdist, or was it more straightforward?
No, I think it was actually less straightforward in a way, which was, you know, I think we were trying to emulate, you know, these particular things that we liked a lot. Like, we were both really into The Residents and certain sort of undergroundy 70s things like that. And so I think we, you know, that was kind of what we wanted to do, was to make tapes of our own that, like, sounded like the cool stuff that we liked. And so it was a little less sort of, you know, in a way, you know, it was less marketable than the stuff we wound up doing like 3 years later. When we made our first record, it, you know, we were making songs that had choruses and verses and middle sections and stuff, and that was kind of more like, you know, something that people could actually sink their teeth into. Although, you know, I mean, the stage show was still pretty mixed up at that point. You know, we had a lot of other stuff going on. Yeah, no, I think the original thing we were doing was a little bit more difficult for people to like.
Where did the name They Might Be Giants come from?
That's a film. It's a film from the early 70s with George C. Scott. And it's not an especially great film, but it was just one of the names. You know, it's like we had this couple of weeks where we were tossing around ideas for band names, and that was one that came up. And it just sounded, in a way, I think the thing that we liked was that it just didn't sound like a lot of other band names at that moment. It sounded like, you know, it wasn't like a provocative sounding name, like, you know, like a lot of contemporary bands, you know, were called like the Dildos and stuff like that at that time. And, you know, we were not trying to go for something like shocking, you know, but I think we wanted to do something that was interesting that didn't remind you of a lot of other stuff. So They Might Be Giants at that time just sounded really different. And, you know, I mean, you don't think very hard about that thing when you're cooking it. You know, I don't think we realized we'd be here 20 years later, like, you know, still doing it. So, and a lot of people don't think about how goofy the Beatles is as a name for a band, you know. I mean, you sort of get over it, I think, eventually.
You started Dial a Song in, what was it, 1985?
That was actually 83. I mean, we'd really just been going for like a year and a half. And John had cooked up this idea of putting a phone machine with songs of ours on it, on his own phone, on his own telephone, and advertising it.
Was that in the Village Voice that you had that
originally? Yeah. We had this ad in the Village Voice, and we advertised in other ways. We had little stickers and things, and, you know. Anyway, we could get people's attention, and we just put the number on everything that we put out, and it just, you know, it just kind of kept going. It was very low maintenance in a way. It was sort of easy. So, it's coming up on. I guess it's been 20 years this year, come to think of it. By the end of this year, it'll be 20 years of Dial a Song.
How effective was that in terms of getting the message out of what you were doing?
Well, I don't know that it got the message out. I think maybe in a way it was more like it was originally this sort of independent thing that people called up, and maybe they were not the same people who came to see us perform. You know, because at that time, the people coming to see us were, like, people in the East Village who were, like, our age, who were just going out to those clubs anyway, or we met them through somebody else or something. It was very word of mouth. So we were not, like, generating a big crowd from anywhere outside of a very local scene, whereas with Dial a Song, I got the impression there were a lot of, like, Wall Streeters and people. You know, that was, like, traveling out beyond our immediate sphere, you know, like people at work called Dial a Song and put it on the speakerphone. We got these phone messages from people like the you know, New York Police Department, people who were, you know, called up to listen to it and were like, shouting out to us, you know, which is very funny. So it was a different world at that time, and it was not, I don't know if it was like advertising the band or being advertised successfully by the band, or if it was just like its own animal that was kind of doing its own thing. I don't think it's ever been a really specifically like an effective tool for advertising what we do. I think it was more like this sidebar conversation piece thing, you know. It was a way for us to get our demos, you know, sort of officially, you know, recorded and put out somehow, and, you know, get sort of feel like we were, you know, putting it out and not necessarily getting feedback because we stopped taking incoming messages very quickly after we started doing it. Hmm. But, you know, it just gave us a sense of we were like, it was an avenue through which to put out our demos that wasn't, you know, an ordinary one by any stretch. It wasn't like our usual give tapes out or whatever.
Yeah. When did your popularity start taking off?
Well, I think it was very gradual, and it took place mainly over the period from, you know, when we started playing in the East Village in the sort of early mid 80s, you know, where we were sort of getting an audience going there. And then from that point through, like, getting a record deal and then putting out two records on an independent label and then putting out the first record on Elektra, which was, you know, it was kind of our biggest splash. And that was in 1990. So it took, you know, it was like over a period of maybe 7 years. Very gradual and not at all like an overnight kind of thing for us. And in some ways that was good, because we were already, you know, we were into our 20s already when we started doing it. So it wasn't like, you know, we were not having some like explosive experience, you know. I think like psychically that was really good for us, that we, you know, we sort of felt like it was under control. And by the time we started having chart hits in the UK and stuff like that, that we were, it didn't go to our heads in any way. And, you know, we sort of felt like we knew what it meant. And we kind of knew, we knew what we still wanted to do, that it wasn't, this wasn't the point of what we'd been doing up until now, was to, like, you know, be on top of the pops or anything like that. That we actually had something more specific and personal about it that we liked, you know.
Was there ever a time that you thought about throwing in the towel?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that we're always surprised when we heard about other bands who declared that they were breaking up, because it seemed like, you know, you could decide to stop touring or something, but in a lot of cases it just seemed unnecessary to say, unless the band members wanted to go off and be in other bands or something like that. It seems sort of like, why would you want to make it official? Why not just, like, stop doing it, and then you can do it some more later if you want, you know? I mean, I think that, you know, there's some certain amount of, like, disingenuous breaking up where the band, like, gets to do a final farewell tour and, you know, they're trying to, like, pump up the numbers or something. But for us, it never seemed necessary. I think we felt like we liked what we were doing. We didn't always like every part of the business. Like, a lot of, you know, I mean, like, I think there have been times when we thought touring was difficult, you know, but we could always just rein that stuff in and focus on other stuff, and we don't have to, like, declare that the entire, you know, empire is, like, come to an end, you know, just because we don't like touring or something like that, you know. You know, I think mainly we sort of felt like we liked the idea of They Might Be Giants, you know, even if we, and it's flexible enough that we get to decide, you know, what, you know, what, I mean, right now, for example, we're doing a lot of commercial work, so we spend a fair amount of the year at home in our studios writing music for TV and stuff like that, and that's completely different from, you know, the, I mean, it's irritating in a different way, but it's not the same as being on the road, you know.
My guest is John Linnell, one half of the rock duo They Might Be Giants. Their most recent tour had them playing three shows in Portland. My interview with John Linnell was recorded on Saturday, May 3rd, 2003, before their first show in Portland.
How effective do you feel that college radio has been in the last 10 or so years as a means of getting your music out there?
Well, I think that it was like a kind of a surprise for us in the first place that there was college radio. I think that we wouldn't really have shown up on the radar if it weren't for college radio in the first place. So it always seemed like gravy to us, you know. I mean, it didn't, being on college radio wasn't like the stepping stone to being, you know, having like continuous chart hits, which we've never had like actual chart hits in America, like single chart hits. So we pretty much have relied on college radio as, you know, the way that we get people's attention, you know. For us, it's been effective. I mean, I don't know what to compare it to. It's like it's its own animal, you know. It's not commercial radio, and we're glad it exists at all. I guess that's my feeling about it.
You guys have been doing the NPR circuit, it seems, a lot lately.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of how that started. I mean, it seems like we sort of fell in one of the things that was sort of a lucky break was we had Sarah Vowell over at This American Life, who decided to do a piece about They Might Be Giants for a show they were doing about the telephone. So she did a whole thing about dial-a-song, and she'd been a big fan of They Might Be Giants. So we kind of got in, you know. They did a really, like, you know, a very flattering piece on us for This American Life, and we got to know Sarah and Ira Glass, and eventually we did other things. We did a show with them in New York that where we were sort of the band while they did their show. We were the house band, and I don't know. We've done, you know, we just sort of managed to. I mean, a lot of it, I think, was like just opportunities that arose. We were on the local NPR show in New York, and the guy who has the noon show there said, you know, I don't have a theme song. So we were like, John, you know, very thoughtfully said, well, we'll write you a theme song. It was pretty much as simple as that. And he's had us on his show a whole bunch of times. I mean, it seems like there's something about NPR that's allows, you know, us to come up with these ad hoc, you know, jobs for ourselves that you know, it's that we're suited to, that, you know, and they're agreeable to, you know. So that's just worked out very well.
A lot of people I'll talk to will say that they've heard of you first from seeing Istanbul and Particle Man, which were on Tiny Toons,
right,
long time ago. How did that come about? And do you have a lot of people who kind of know of you from that?
Well, more and more now, because the people who saw Tiny Toons when they were 11 are now old enough to go, you know, to concerts and stuff. So there's tons of. I mean, it's funny. It's because at the time it just seemed like this. Again, it was just like a sidebar. We were already doing this college thing. In fact, at that time, you know, we had this, you know, huge selling college radio record. So it seemed like doing a thing like Tiny Toons was. We weren't thinking in terms of like, creating an audience for 10 years later that we could then harvest, you know. It was just like a funny thing. It was a very easy job because the animators just said, we want to use these two songs off of Flood. You don't have to do anything. You know, here's some money. And we didn't even really have a clear idea of what the show was all about. It was like, I mean, frankly, it sounded a little bit weird. It was like described to us as, well, this is Steven Spielberg taking Warner Brothers characters and making sort of cute little baby versions of them. You know, and we were like, whatever, you know, knock yourselves out, you know. So that, you know, that was pretty much the extent of our involvement with it.
There's a noticeable difference between 1992's Apollo 18 and John Henry, which you put out in 84, mainly that you added a live band. Mm-hmm. Did the grunge explosion that happened in between those albums have anything to do with that choice?
No, I mean, I think we pretty much demonstrated. I think with John Henry, it was sort of like pretty obvious that we were not going with the flow, you know, and we were on the outs with the British press immediately. As soon as John Henry came out, I think there was this feeling like these guys have lost it completely, you know, because we were, you know, I think there are elements of Apollo 18 that were maybe kind of in accord with, like, stuff that was going on at that time, but John Henry was really not at all. It didn't sound anything like Nirvana or whatever it was people wanted to hear at that moment. So, you know, I think a lot of people thought, you know, that we had just kind of wandered off and were completely ignoring, you know, the current cultural climate. And I guess that's kind of true. I mean, I think we decided to put a band together, but it was like a band with a horn section and, you know, keyboard heavy, and it just didn't sound like the other stuff that was going on at that time.
What was, like, general fan reaction at the time outside the press?
I think it was mixed. I mean, some people really liked it, you know. I think that the songwriting, you know, was really great on that record, you know, and I think it's probably true that we were not 100% clear on what we were doing. You know, we mainly just wanted to try and put a band together. We didn't know exactly what it was supposed to sound like, but we, you know, we were not specifically trying to avoid sounding contemporary or anything. And we just, you know, it's just what we thought would sound good, basically, you know, working with the musicians that we had. And, you know, I think a lot of... I mean, there are people who say it's their favorite record, and there's some people who, you know, say that they fell off at that particular record, you know, like they liked everything up until then, you know, so... I mean, it really is mixed.
How would you describe you and John's philosophy of life, and how does that not make it into... your songwriting.
Right, I understand.
Well, I mean, someone could listen to your lyrics and say, like, you know, I think these guys are nihilists, kind of thing.
Oh,
like,
I see what you mean. Well, you know, I think that, I mean, the other thing about the lyrics is that again, I mean, this is like sort of more of like of our attitude about songwriting, but I think that the lyrics are not, you know, our own thoughts, like, projected onto a song in the way that... I think there's this popular misconception about, like, a lot of songwriting, which is that the person is just speaking in this perfectly unscreened, unfiltered way. You know, that if there's someone in the song who says, I do this, that's the person who wrote it talking. Whereas, you know, you don't think that about when you're reading a work of fiction, that the person who's talking is the author of the book. You know, if it's a narrator, you know that it's the writer, the guy writing the book is writing a character who's then, he's the narrator, you know. So they're two different guys, you know, one's fake and one's real. And that's how we feel about our songs. The songs are objects, you know, they're not us just expressing ourselves freely, you know. I mean, John and I don't work that way, and we don't have a problem with people who do. I mean, I think there are a lot of good songwriters who do just put everything on their sleeves, you know, and just spell it out, like, what they did that day or whatever, and they use their actual friends' names in their songs and everything, and, you know, that's fine, but that's not at all what we do. The characters in our songs are not us. You know, we like writing songs kind of like the way we're, you know... We like to have the freedom when we're writing to just make up fictitious, you know, narrators in the songs, you know, and that's, I mean, I think that's the way we've always worked.
Who were some of your early influences?
Well, you know, obviously we've been asked this question a bunch of times, so I have a kind of a ready list in my mind, and I feel like I don't even think very hard when I'm answering this question now, but it always begins with the Beatles, you know, partly because of John and I were born, you know, around 1960. You know, I was born in 59, he was born in 60. So we were at that age where that was kind of like the big event when we were kids. And then in the 70s, you know, I think we started to get the sense that there was other music that was not mass market, that was actually, you know, like that you could like something that wasn't just for everybody, you know. So there was like more specific stuff. So I think we both kind of got interested in punk rock and stuff like that after that. And you know, there's a few specific songwriters that we liked a lot when we were young. You know, I always liked Elvis Costello a lot when I was a teenager because it just seemed like this very pure kind of songwriting, and technically it was the kind of thing that I dug, you know, because it was sort of based on the Beatles, you know. Yeah, I mean, I guess there's been a lot of stuff since then, but it's very hard to get out from under the shadow of the Beatles, you know, when you're from our generation, I think.
Who are you listening to now?
Well, let's see. I don't, you know, there's nobody specific that I've been listening to a lot. I mean, I don't really even listen to music that much. John Flansburgh pays a lot more attention to what's going on, and you know, he's a kind of more interesting person to ask that question to, because he has, you know, more sort of nuanced opinions about stuff. But you know, I guess I really like the Missy Elliott record that came out last year. That was probably my favorite record of last year. Trying to think of what else. I like the Teenage Fan Club record from last. Well, I guess it's from earlier, but I think maybe it came out in America last year or something like that. Anyway, that was something I listened to. You know, I find like I often listen to my friends. Like, you know, I've met people while, you know, in the time we've been doing this, and because I know them personally, I'm kind of more interested in their thing, and I know that's not, you know, it's a little bit like blinkered, you know, like I don't have as wide of a view of what's going on, but I do like hearing stuff by people that I know. But like I said, I'm you know, I should tell you, my wife really listens to a lot of different stuff, and she is kind of the source for me of most of what's new, you know. I mean, she's the one who introduced me to, like, the, you know, the White Stripes and the, you know, the Strokes and all the Swedish bands, you know. I mean, the Hives and everybody. We, you know, she goes out. She likes to go and see shows, which I usually don't, but I'll go with her. And, so I've seen good shows when I've been just going out with her. I mean, I spend a lot of time in clubs as it is, but I really enjoyed the Hives show in New York last year. That was funny.
It was about a year ago that the Gigantic movie came out. Mm-hmm. Is that right? Now, is it slated for more of a mass release now?
Yeah, it's getting a sort of an art house release pretty much, you know, as we speak. It's hitting all the big art houses. It's coming to New York in a few weeks, and I mean, it's already had sort of limited runs in places, and it's played in a lot of festivals and things. But yeah, it'll be getting the same. It's distributed by the same people that did the Wilco movie, and it will be out on DVD after that. And, you know, same kind of deal.
What's your guys' immediate future in terms of touring and, like, your next album?
Well, we have, you know, a lot of songs that we've written, and we haven't really had a moment to go into a studio and start working on them yet. So that theoretically is going to happen this year, but we're, you know, it keeps getting pushed back. So we'll see. I mean, I'm hoping that we'll actually have something out by the end of this year. And I'm looking forward to that because I think we've got a lot of good new songs.
What do you see as like the long range future of They Might Be Giants?
Well, you know, I think that we pretty much have been doing what we will be doing. You know, I don't think there's anything like drastically different in store that we know about now. But we're trying to continue to pick up commercial gigs, like do TV themes and stuff like that. That's something that we like doing. That's fun and makes money. And we will probably put out another children's record at some point, but you know, not before we've done more adult, you know, material where we can play shows where we get to swear and stuff like that. You know. Yeah, I don't know. Beyond that, I mean, John's wife is working on has basically created this sort of off-Broadway musical thing with a friend of hers, and they are in the process of hatching, you know, a whole production of that, which, you know, if that takes off, then I think John will be busy with that for a while, and if he does wind up doing that, then I might wind up doing some more solo work or something, you know, in the interim. But that's, you know, we'll see. We'll mm-hmm. see what happens with that. Anyway, like I said, They Might Be Giants is just sort of always there in the background, you know. And, you know, I think we feel like it's very reliable at this point, you know. Like, it's a job that we both like a lot, you know.
Well, I want to thank you for talking. And
nice talking to you.
Yeah. Hope we get to do it again next time we're in town.
Very good.
My guest was John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. He spoke with us in the green room of Portland's Aladdin Theater on May 3rd, 2003, before their show. You can find out more about his band by going to tmbg.com. In Portland, Oregon, I'm Dave Cusick for KPSU, Portland's College Radio. KPSU.